Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. My name is Glenn Sizemore. I'm a reference architect with NetApp. I am the Microsoft Private Cloud reference architect. Today we're going to be talking about how to maximize the benefits of Microsoft Cloud, specifically with in relation to automation, security, self-service, and provisioning, kind of the core tenets of cloud. I do work for NetApp. This session is going to be very NetApp-centric because those are the integration points that I'm most familiar with. But honestly, everything we're going to discuss works regardless of who you use for storage. The real point here is how to build these solutions. How do you plug them together? How do the components interact? So even if you're not interested in our products, I think you'll still find some value here. For those of you who are actually in the room and not on the recording, we are going to be raffling off a $500 gift card at the end of this because my alliance manager likes to give away money. All right. On the agenda today, we're going to start off with a very brief introduction to NetApp for those of you who are new to us and not familiar with what we do, so you understand where I'm coming from. We're going to move on and start walking our way down the solution stack. So we're going to start with Windows Server 2012 itself, get into the core hypervisor, then we'll bump up the stack a level, focus on System Center 2012 R2, the Microsoft Private Cloud, and then we'll finish the evening with a conversation on how to extend into the public cloud and what that really means from an enterprise perspective. So who's NetApp? We're a storage company. As of 2013, we are recognized as one of the Fortune 500. 77% of the Fortune 500 are NetApp customers. We have earned a bit of a reputation as being a pretty cool place to work. We're no Google, but we're no slouch either. Last year, we were the number 3 best multinational workplace in the globe. And for 12 consecutive years, we've been on Fortune 500's 100 best companies to work for. While that does no good for you, I just bring that up to mention that we really strive to make it a fun place to work where engineers want to build good solutions and help our customers. And that's what enables us to realize some success. Success like the fact that we are the number 1 storage provider for the United States government, as well as the number 1 storage provider for the public cloud worldwide. Those are pretty big hit points. But the final one is really the one that matters to me. NetApp is the creator of and caretaker to the industry's number 1 storage management operating system, Data on Tap. That's the OS that runs inside our storage controllers, and it is responsible for the maintenance and control of more petabytes of storage than any other OS in the world. Actually, it's probably up to an exabyte at this point. We also happen to be Microsoft's 2013 Server Platform Partner of the Year. This one's kind of funny. You know, we don't sell Windows. We have no ability to sell Windows. If you want Windows Server, you got to go talk to somebody else. All I can give you is storage. But we'll get into how that happened. In 2012, we were also honored to be to win Microsoft's Private Cloud Partner of the Year, and then, of course, in 2009, Storage Solutions Partner of the Year. So you can kind of see a ramp, right, starting from just storage integration up into private cloud, and then finally hitting server platforms. So how do we do that? The short version is we listened to what Microsoft told us their customers wanted. They build platforms. Those platforms have APIs and extensions. And if you build your products correctly, they can natively integrate with those APIs and extensions and give the customer the best possible experience. Not some third-party server that everything hooks through or a management stack that requires them to go through multiple portals, but stay within the Microsoft experience and do so natively. Here we have a brief smattering of NetApp's integration with Microsoft. Here we've got the various layers of the physical infrastructure stack with the Microsoft component that services that layer of the stack. And in green, we have the NetApp plugin that natively integrates with that solution. So for instance, of course, automation in Windows these days is done with PowerShell. We have our Data on Tap PowerShell toolkit, which we're going to talk a little bit about later. And so forth and so on throughout the stack. So again, real brief, that's who NetApp is. If you'd like to learn more, we're down on the expo floor, booth 600. We can get into all the details. So now let's get into why you're here in the first place. Let's start off again with Windows Server 2012 R2. Windows Server 2012 was very much a revolutionary release in just about every way that matters. The release cycle, the cadence, the feature capacity, the way that it deploys, everything about it was revolutionary. Here we are 2.5 years later, and I'm still myself grasping with stuff that was released in that release. And now we've got 2012 R2. So it's just coming faster and heavier in this continuous release cycle, and it's going to accelerate even further as Microsoft moves to this 3-month release cadence. But there was a couple of key protocols and a couple of key payloads that are critical to you maximizing the benefit of your core infrastructure and getting the best ROI out of that converged platform. The first one I want to talk about is SMB 3.0, right? Storage protocol. SMB 3.0 fundamentally changes the types of solutions that we are able to build as architects. It is a big deal. And the reason that it's a big deal is because it gives us the simplicity of a NAS-based protocol, right? One big bucket that you just throw stuff into, with the availability that we traditionally have only ever associated with block-based protocols. And to explain exactly how that works, I'm going to walk you through a couple failure scenarios so you get a better understanding of what's going on in the back end. First of which is going to be a client failure scenario. So here we have a two-node Hyper-V cluster. This could be SQL Server, anything that supports SMB. And then we have a four-node scale-out storage cluster on the back end. We're not going to get into storage. It really doesn't matter. In this case, node 2 is connected to storage node 2 on Lyft 2. For some reason, node 2 has a catastrophic failure, right? Admin walks in the data center, trips over a power cord, sparks go flying, servers offline. Windows Server Failover Clustering kicks in, instantaneously detects the failure, determines quorum, relocates the application to the surviving node, where it then restores services. This look familiar? This is exactly how it's worked for the past 15, 20 years. That's the message. That's the thing. That's step one. Step one is understanding that nothing has changed. Clustering is still clustering. Just because we're changing the storage protocol doesn't mean we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You don't have to relearn how everything functions. We're just changing how you bring the storage to the actual application itself. We're removing the complexity of pools. We're removing the complexity of CSVs and drive letters and mount points and just going to a commodity pool on a UNC path. So what about that UNC path? How do we make that highly available? How is that continuous availability managed, or what we call it, NetApp non-disruptive operations? Well, for that, let's go through failure scenario two. So here we have, again, our two-node cluster, and we have our two-node HA storage pair. Now, in our case, on the back end, we're running what's known as the SMB witness protocol. Witness is a third party that sits outside of the transaction and just watches the client communication. And in the event of a failure, will proactively notify the client that a failure has occurred and provide reconnect instructions, right? So it's exactly what its name intends. Now, in our case, Witness is redundant because we actually handle the resiliency a layer beneath that. But I bring it up because Witness is how most of this works, right? If you have a Windows Server scale-out file cluster, Witness is how you get your HA feature. That is what makes it non-disruptive and continuously available. Same is true for a lot of other options. Now, in our case, here we have, a virtual machine, a SQL database, whatever have you, anything on an SMB3 share. Connects into Lyft 4 on node 4. It creates what's known as a persistent file handle, right? That's the actual token that represents the SMB session itself. That file handle is then replicated to the other partner node inside the HA pair. Now, this becomes important on failure. So, again, same admin, after tripping over the power cord, just decides to walk through the data center, this time with a pot of coffee for some reason, and just dumps it down the front of the storage controller. Everything panics. It's a disaster. Now, what's going to happen in our case is cluster data on tap is going to instantaneously recognize the network failure and do a Lyft migrate to move the physical logical interface to the surviving node, where it just so happens we have an exact copy of the persistent file handle that's being used for that SMB3 session. Hyper-V will get a reverse ARP up through the network stack and do a reconnect. This happens so fast, 9 times out of 10, you're not even going to know that something broke. It is an order of magnitude faster and more resilient than what we can get with block. And the reason for that is because we're cheating, right? With block, when you have a failure, there's 30 or 40 steps associated with just getting the right locks on the device so that you can start reading the data. You got to get your persistent reservations, go through the SCSI locks, make sure there's not other utilization. There's scenarios where you can get lock collisions. It can get kind of messy. With SMB, you just connect. And since we now have a mechanism to non-disruptively relocate these services and to proactively notify the clients, that reconnect is instant. The second the failure occurs, Hyper-V just goes, okay, over here, got it, and re-goes. Not even a hitch. So that's the first thing that I want to make sure you guys kind of wrap your heads around. This is a real quick high-level overview, but the real take-home here and the thing that I want you to walk away with is that upfront sentence. The simplicity of a file-based share with the availability of block-based storage, right? That's really the future. And that's where I think all of our workloads are going to go, just to remove the overhead. That doesn't mean you're getting rid of block. There's still purposes for it. There's still use cases where it has advantages. It just means that you're not going to boot your VMs off it because it's a waste of time. And it's a waste of complexity that you don't need. The next protocol I want to make sure you guys are aware of is something called copy offload or offloaded data transfer, ODX. You guys heard of ODX before? Hands up. About a third of the room. Okay. So to explain why this is important, I'm going to walk you through an ODX transfer so you get the concept of how this actually functions. And then throughout the rest of this presentation, I'm going to show you a couple of instances where this natively kicks in inside the Microsoft Cloud environment to seamlessly accelerate your deployments. So here we have a user-initiated file copy. It does not matter where this comes from, right? Right-click copy in File Explorer, PowerShell, Robocopy, .NET developer calling the Win32 copy API. Anywhere in Windows that a copy is initiated, Windows is going to break up that copy into 8 meg sections. And for each 8 meg chunk or section, it's going to send what's known as an offload read to the storage destination. Basically sends down a logical block address range that represents the actual data in that 8 meg chunk and says, hey, I would like to perform an offload read for this data. If the destination storage device supports ODX, it then hands back a token that represents that data. It doesn't stream it, right? It doesn't write back out 8 megs of data onto the network. It hands back a single 4K token that represents that actual data itself. That token that gets transferred to the destination. So we're sending the token over the wire. For each 8 megs of each 8 meg chunk of data, we send a single 4K token over the network. It's pretty simple to realize how much network congestion that removes off your production network. But the really interesting part is what happens when we get to the destination. The token is then redeemed by the storage target, where the storage target then copies and starts the copy, initiates it, and waits till it's complete. Completely on the back end, right? By definition, ODX cannot use the production network. It has to use a back end network, whether that's in the controller or through a controller interconnect network or a back end array scale out network. It doesn't matter, but it cannot go through the production network. Once the copy is completed, then we send back a copy complete notification. Now, the reason that last part is important is, as you'll see when we go through the rest of this presentation today, even though this is a completely offloaded copy transfer and Windows Server is not involved in the actual streaming file copy in any way, shape, or form, you still have up-to-the-minute notification as to where we're at in the copy status. Your file copy window is going to continue to have a progress and throughput bar. Any tools that utilize copy progress utilization are going to get the feedback loop that they need to know how far into the operation they are. And if at any point in time something goes wrong, Windows is going to fall back and just start streaming it through the network again. So it is completely transparent, and it just works. That's really the beauty of what they've done. This was implemented as a standard. It's implemented in both the T10 standard for SCSI as well as the SMB 3.0 dialect itself. There are no plugins. There is no integration point. All you do is point Windows Server 2012 or 2012 R2 at an ODX-compliant device, and it'll just start firing. And you guys are going to see the real advantage of that here in a second. So those are the two big protocols that you need to be aware of. There's some other stuff in the network that, quite frankly, is massive. But we only have an hour, and we're trying to get through a lot. So if you want to get into that, come see us downstairs. But those are the two big ones I wanted to make sure we touched on. The next thing we want to talk about is storage management. Microsoft started with storage with Windows Server 2012 R2, or with Windows Server 2012, rather, I'm sorry. With 2012 R2, they're extending this concept to the network, and they're continuing to push out into the data center. Eventually, Windows Server is going to have the ability to manage the entire data center from a bare metal footprint, and I can't wait till that day, because that's going to be a good day for administrators. But for right now, we're still kind of in this middle ground. A good place to see where we're going, though, is storage, because this is where we started. If we take a look at what Microsoft did, they started by saying, hey, guys, your general workload automation platform, that's Windows PowerShell. At NetApp, we listened to that feedback and built what we call the Data on Tap PowerShell Toolkit. It is a community-driven product from NetApp. Community-driven meaning if you don't like the way it works, you tell us about it, and we fix it. We don't take product feedback from large customers. We take product feedback from anybody who will give it to us. We have a quarterly release cycle, so rapid iteration is how this product has grown over the past 3 years. And as of version 3.1, we're currently sitting at about 1,400 commandlets. If we take a look at Windows Server 2012 R2, PowerShell gets pretty important, and not because of PowerShell itself. The real reason PowerShell becomes important is because of DSC, desired state configuration and declarative management. PowerShell integration is a required element to do that. And eventually, once everyone gets their head around this and we all as an industry learn how to utilize these tools, we are going to move to a declarative model. It's not if, it's not maybe, it will happen. Because a configuration file that sets an end state and says, hey server, this is what you look like, and an automation platform that just does that without any kind of code, there's no way to defend that not winning. It's going to happen. And this is how you get there. PowerShell integration is where it starts. Now, that's not the only way that you manage storage inside Windows. The other interfaces, again, standards-based management. So this is the native integration point, right? PowerShell integration exposed out through SIM and DMTIF. But then we have standards-based management, in this case done through SMIS or SNP, Storage Management Protocol. SMIS integration, again, SMIS, Storage Management Initiative Specification, is a DMTF standard specification for managing storage that is ran by SNIA, the Storage Network Industry Associates. This is a completely third-party industry that is made up of members in the industry, right? So NetApp and EMC and HP and all the various players in the space, to include Microsoft and Red Hat even, get together and talk about what types of interfaces we need. Now, NetApp, our SMIS agent, version 5.1 is the current version, supports all currently shipping versions of our Data on Tap product. It is agent-based. It can be run either in Windows or Linux, so we are heterogeneous friendly, and has passed the SNIA conformance testing program, CTP 1.5. The reason I bring that up is because this is what drives VMM, standards-based management. So we have a standards-based protocol whereby VMM is able to communicate with any third-party device, regardless of its manufacturer. And you as the administrator have a common administrative path to getting a DAS done, again, regardless of manufacturer. The beauty of standards-based management is you could have, you know, a foo array today, and you have a workflow that says ABC, and tomorrow you replace that array with a bar array, and the workflow is still ABC. The problem with standards-based management, it is a least common denominator, meaning this only knows how to do what everybody can do. So there's no integration for the advanced features of your storage platforms. So we need to have a Rubicon, right? We're going to need a little bit of both. We're going to need a little bit of DSC to bring in the intelligence and the advanced features, whether they be from NetApp or our competitors. And we're also going to need the standards-based approach to handle the things everyone can do. And one of those things happens to be VM provisioning. We're going to see that that is a big, big, big part of the Microsoft Private Cloud. And then finally, you got your GUIs, right? Your legacy add-in integration. In NetApp, that's our SnapDrive for Windows product. Honestly, in the Microsoft Cloud environment today, most of the storage provisioning is going to be done through either SMIS or PowerShell directly. The days of storage company-based GUI integration being the primary interface by which you provision your storage, those are past. Right? The operating system is now intelligent enough to do it natively, and if they're trying to drive you through a third portal, don't listen to them. They need to plug into the native OS, because only by doing that are we going to be able to continue to improve that experience and continue to drive the innovation and increase its availability. For us, this SnapDrive for Windows becomes our backup API. This is how we ship our remote VSS, volume shadow copy services requester, which is important for backup and recovery scenarios. So that's storage management. Again, key takeaways: got to have PowerShell, mandatory. Any vendor that is telling you that they're not considering it, you should find somebody else. Really, at this point, it's not acceptable. And then standards-based management. You know, don't accept those third custom portals. Standards-based management is the key for you, because it removes the complexity. It removes what we in the industry call stickiness. Right? Stickiness is when it's hard for you to change vendors. Stickiness is good for me. It's bad for you, right? So that's why you want to always lead with standards-based management whenever you can. All right, so let's take a look at what we can do. So here we have our on-command GUI. This is just a visual to show you what we've got here. And I've got a cluster data on tap storage controller up here with a couple of what we call storage virtual machines or virtual storage controllers. And I'm going to go into Windows Server 2012 R2, and I'm just going to open up a PowerShell prompt, and we're going to do some storage provisioning. I'm going to create a Business Guns VM, right, or a Business Guns virtual storage controller. To do so, I'm going to connect into the storage controller itself. And now we're going to do complete tenancy deployment. So this starts by creating a new vServer or a new tenant container to house all of our components. Once that's complete, we're going to then set the protocols that this storage container is going to allow. In this case, we're going to use SIFS and iSCSI. And then we create a network LIF or an interface for it to communicate across. Once that's done, we create a volume or a storage pool to provision our storage out of. And now we're going to configure SMB. So we configure DNS down here at the bottom, and then add our storage controller into Active Directory. Now we're in Active Directory. We just configured the default user, and then add a new SMB 3.0 share. The way that what makes this 3.0 is right here, continuously available. Now that we've created our share, we're going to create a new virtual machine utilizing that share. And there we go. In about 35 seconds and 10 commands, we provisioned a complete secure tenant storage controller, provisioned dedicated storage for that tenant, provisioned isolated network access, and deployed a VM. And if we go back to our UI, we can see our Business Guns VM come in. That's the power of PowerShell, the fact that you can get native integration into everything. Right? The standards-based protocols, that's how you get to the stuff that you do every day. But there are going to be edge cases where you go in and go, you know, this is 3/4 of what I need, but I'm still missing 25%. PowerShell is going to close that last 25%, right? So that's storage management. Now let's talk about backup and recovery. Real quick. So backup and recovery is really only important if you're still in what we're starting to call the PETS model, right? There's, you guys all heard and been smacked over the head with DevOps enough yet? A couple of you. So there's this whole concept of cattle and pets, right? Pets is the traditional IT model where you have servers that you care about and you feed them and you pay attention to them and you watch their event logs. And then there's this whole new model of DevOps, which we traditionally associate with Web 2.0, where you don't care about your systems at all. If anything goes wrong, you shoot it in the head and you deploy another one. They call it cattle. It's kind of cruel, but it's funny. The vast majority of the industry is not ready for cattle. There are a couple people who are. You know, the shining example right now is Stack Exchange. They're kind of showing us how to do this with Windows Server. Their lead architect, Steve Morosky, is doing a lot of great work publishing it out there to the world. But IT is still in the pets model. Enterprises, they still have pets. And when you have pets, you have to take care of them. And part of taking care of them is backing them up. And at NetApp, the way that we do that is through our Snap Manager for Hyper-V products. I'm just going to cover our integration, but really the key takeaway for this is going to be you're going to need a hardware-based snapshot provider, and I'm going to explain to you why here in a minute. In our case, we have the ability to do crash and application consistent backups. Quick conversation on this as well. So what does that mean, crash consistent and application consistent? Application consistent is where we go through and use the volume shadow copy services to quiesce I/O from within the guest, right? That's what we know is a traditional non-good backup. For a application, that is a must. But for infrastructure, for virtual machines, I'm going to go ahead and tell you it's a little bit redundant. Because at the end of the day, you're backing up the application running in the VM. The VM level backup has one job and one job only. Get the OS back to a state so that we can restore the application to begin with. So the only time you need to run an application consistent backup is when you're dealing with a virtual machine that you're not backing up with another utility. For instance, if you're not using Windows Backup to back up a domain controller, you need to use app consistent backups because otherwise when you restore the VM, there's a potential for it to be corrupt, right? But if you are backing up the application data, which you should be, let's say it's a SQL server, then crash consistent is more than enough. And the main reason that you want to have the option is because while VSS is very reliable, it is also so slow. It takes about 90 seconds to 3 minutes per VM to actually quiesce an average file system. If it's under a heavy stress, it can take up to 5 or 6 minutes, right? 1,000 VMs, 90 seconds apiece, you do the math. We're going to be here a while, right? Crash consistent, on the other hand, skips all that and says, okay, 1,000 VMs, done. So it enables you to realize SLAs that otherwise just aren't achievable with any other solution in the market. And when you're talking about infrastructure in particular, this is a capability that you're going to want, especially as we continue to stay in the PATS model. In Hyper-V in particular, we have two different mechanisms to back stuff up. We have traditional cluster shared volumes and this concept of distributed backups. In Windows Server 2008, the way that it worked is you'd have a CSV, 4 nodes. Node 1 would back up all its VMs, move the CSV to node 2. Node 2 would back up all the VMs, move the CSV to node 3. Node 3 would back up all the VMs, move it to node 4. Node 4 would back up all the VMs. It took forever. They completely threw the baby out with the bathwater in Server 2012 and iterated again on it in 2012 R2, and we have this concept of a distributed backups. Here we have a single CSV. We have 4 nodes. Job comes in. All 4 nodes concurrently back up all the virtual machines. Once everything's in a consistent state, we take a single hardware-based snapshot on the controller and move on. It is an order of magnitude faster based on the number of nodes. So if you have 64 nodes in your cluster, it is 64 times faster. It's pretty simple math. SMB 3.0 implements a new and interesting protocol, remote VSS. Remote VSS is how we remotely trigger a volume shadow copy request for an SMB 3.0 share. So now let's take a look at what this looks like and why this matters. Again, this is our product, but backup is one of those things where pick the vendor you like. If you don't have a solution, we've got a pretty damn awesome one. But if you have someone you're happy with, keep using them. It's fine. So here we've got our SAN Manager Hyper-V product. I'm going to go into protection, and you can see here I've got that same BizGuns VM because, you know, we got to run business. And we're going to go through and back it up. Now, in this case, I'm going to do an application consistent backup. I can set a retention period, integrate my DR strategy, and, of course, PowerShell script, right? So there's the command to run this backup if you want to automate it. Go ahead and click Next. And now we're going to fast forward a little bit once we get to the execute backup, because again, it takes about 3 minutes. But there you can see the backup task is complete. Now, we go into the reports. We can see that it's completed successfully. Now we're going to do something that is, stupid. We're going to go in and we're going to power off our VM, connect into the actual storage itself, and produce what I like to call a resume generating event. Connect into the VM, try to power it on. Oh no, I deleted the wrong file. I'm so fired. Have no fear, we have a backup. So now we're just going to go back into our recovery product, hit refresh. There we can see the backup that we just took. We're just going to click restore. Again, same view script, so this can be automated, which means we can put it into orchestration and workflow for automatic recovery. Now, this is live. No editing, no modification, no speeding up. So we take the VM offline. We execute the VSS restore. And then we start the VM. So that's about 20 seconds for complete virtual machine recovery. Here's the beauty of this. It doesn't matter how big that file is. That could be 10 terabytes. It's still 20 seconds. That's the power of a hardware-based provider, because you are using hardware to lock away the blocks in your protection. And when you're dealing with whole VMs, if you're going to offer backup as a service at the virtual machine level, how long it takes to get the VM back is actually pretty darn important. Because especially when we take a look at modern provisioning systems, if I can provision a new virtual machine in 3 minutes, and I can have a sysprep SQL installation, and I can install SQL and get it back up and running and join back into the database in, 15 minutes, then if my backup takes 30 minutes, what good is it? It's faster to rebuild the VM. Now, it's harder, right? There's other integration, so there's reasons to back it up. But that's why I say that, the hardware-based provider is actually pretty important. But again, you know, if you're happy with your solution, stay with it. But in order to maximize the benefit, in order to get the most out of your infrastructure and give the business the most amount of value to what you're doing, a hardware-based provider is key. So now let's move on. Let's bump up the stack and talk about System Center and the Microsoft Private Cloud. So there are two critical components to System Center, two critical components to the cloud infrastructure that regardless of what you do, where the integration needs to be. The rest of the product suite just kind of works with itself, right? But there are two places where your vendors need to provide you the integration for you to get the most out of it. The first of which is Operations Manager. Operations Manager, of course, is where we do the monitoring of the Microsoft Cloud environment. Now, NetApp, our integration into that plugin is our, into that product, is our on-command plugin for Microsoft product. Here we have a simple view of our management pack inside Operations Manager. And the real thing I want to call out here is Operations Manager integration is not a single MP that does green, yellow, red alerting and tells you something's wrong. In order for this product to function correctly, you need to give it the detailed hierarchical information and linkage for the objects that are available to the third-party store, right? In other words, under enclosure services, if I zoom in, I can see the cooling elements of my enclosure and the power supplies. If I go over to the storage node level, I can see my physical ports, the disks, the aggregates or storage pools, the RAID levels, every individual component. If I zoom into the storage virtual machine layer, I can see the actual volumes and logical lifts associated with the SVM and the data stores and SMB3 shares. Why does this matter? Well, this matters because if you don't do it correctly, then when something goes wrong, all you know is it's broken. If you do it correctly, then when an admin accidentally unplugs power supply 2, power supply 2 is going to trigger the health event services that notifies node 2 that Agger 2 is at risk because it lost the shelf because the power supply is no longer redundant, which is then going to make storage virtual machine 1 at risk because it could potentially lose Agger 2, which means that your virtual machines running on data store 2, which there happen to be of about 3,000 of them, are all at risk. That's why it matters. Without that deep level of object discovery, Operations Manager can't do what it was actually designed to do, which is jump up and say, hey guys, over here, this one plug, go fix it quickly before something goes bad, right? If all it does is say, something's broke, then you have to still go out there and figure out what's wrong. So that's what we mean by management pack integration. And at this point, Operations Manager isn't new, guys. You know, this thing was bought almost 15 years ago. It's been rewritten twice. You know, the fact that we're still having this conversation is actually a little bit embarrassing. But don't take it from your vendors, right? This is how it needs to work for it to function correctly. Another consideration, of course, is management pack reporting. If you use SCUM reporting, it can be very powerful and very useful. The key takeaway here is all of the information that flows into Operations Manager is then carried into the data warehouse so that it can be used for analytical services later on. Inside our OCPM 4.0 product, we do include 22 sample reports, but all the performance analysis is in there and is available for use. For instance, average latency, that's a pretty important one. That's a good way to trend growth. You know, if you do a two-year cycle report and 2 years ago your average latency was 3 milliseconds and today it's 17 milliseconds, then there's a pretty reasonable assumption that in 3 months you're going to start running into performance problems. Now, of course, that's a gross simplification of the problem, but it's just to get the point across that that data warehouse is there, and if you choose to leverage it, you can get some pretty powerful analytics out of it. Okay, so that's Operations Manager. Now we're going to move on to the real heart of the Microsoft Cloud. Virtual Machine Manager, it's kind of funny, man. VMM started off as this weird thing when it was first introduced, and it seemed overcomplicated, and it didn't work very well. But if we take a look at where we're at today, VMM is the most important component System Center ever shipped. Today, it is the heart of the Microsoft private cloud infrastructure. And the way that it's architected and the way that it abstracts away the various layers enable us to build pretty powerful infrastructures. Our native integration into Virtual Machine Manager, of course, is our DatonTap SMIS agent, because As we'll see here in a second, Virtual Machine Manager uses standard space management for third-party storage arrays these days. Before we move on to that, though, so another component that you can that can really help again maximize your benefit is pro tips. Right? Pro tips, again, not something that's very new. Performance resource optimization, pro. Basically, it's a mechanism whereby operations manager can communicate bidirectionally with Virtual Machine Manager, and they can coordinate both the notification and automatic remediation of a problem. Right. So the way to think about this is SCOM without a pro tip is a four-year-old that just runs in your room and starts screaming, the light's on, the light's on, the light's on, the light's on. There's no way to get them to turn the light off. You have to get out of bed, go and turn it off yourself, and then they'll finally stop. A pro tip is an adult that walks in and goes, hey, the light's on. You go, can you get that? You go, yeah, sure, I got it. All better. Takes care of itself. Right? So it can really simplify your architecture and make the administration easier. It's not mandatory. It just makes it easier. So now I want to take a real quick look at what standards-based management means inside Virtual Machine Manager and how this actually makes your job easier. So here we have our Virtual Machine Manager infrastructure VM host app here is our application hosting cluster. It's a small four-node cluster. We also have our Fabric Management cluster running concurrently. So here we have our private cloud architecture. There's nothing exposed via it yet. We're going to go in and provision some storage. So to do that, we go to storage providers and say, create file share. I pick my storage virtual machine I'm going to deploy against, give it a simple name, pick a storage pool, give it a classification, and a size in megabytes. As easy as it has ever been. If I go to jobs, I can see that it's going to reach out through that SMIS provider and create the file share on the source target. So now to provision the file share, all I do is go to the cluster level object, go to file share storage, click add, and then select the share that we provisioned through the provider. Click OK twice, and it's going to automatically reach out again through the SMIS provider, set all the NTFS permissions, update the host placement paths and the default paths for virtual machine storage. And now my private cloud now has resources available to it. So now let's create a VM and actually utilize that storage that we just provisioned. I'm going to go in, select my template, give it a simple name, pick the hardware profile. We're going to deploy to a private cloud. You can see all our hosts are even with no warnings. And then hit go. Now if we go in here, I want you to look down here. See where it says using fast file copy? Fast file copy is ODX. Look at the performance of this actual deployment. We're running at about 650 megs a second. That's not SSDs. That's not throwing massive pipes at it. That's just using intelligent offloads. That's what I mean by you're going to want to look into this protocol. Virtual Machine Manager now natively knows how to communicate through the SMIS provider with ODX. And as you see, you're going to see here in a couple of minutes, this means that everything now knows how to utilize this protocol. Everything. It changes everything. Okay? So that's a real quick look at VMM. We could honestly talk about VMM's integration with the Microsoft Cloud for a couple days. It's gotten kind of ridiculous with the amount of features in the product. But from a high level, those are the two kind of simple, from a high level, those are the two takeaway points, right? Simplified storage administration for your Hyper-V environment, whether it be block-based LUNs, right? Fiber channel to include zoning of the fiber channel fabric, iSCSI, SMB3, virtual machine deployment, and now accelerated deployments through ODX, all of which is done through standards-based integration. Which means that you can buy an array from me and implement your workflows. And if you don't like the way that I do business with you, or if my prices aren't competitive enough for you, you can take me out and you can put another guy in, and everything stays the same. You guys get that? That's the most important part. You standardize your provisioning models, and you don't have to tear it up every 3 years and re-implement everything. Once it's running, it runs no matter who you install on. So we're commoditizing the entire stack, not just the servers. We've had that flexibility forever now. You buy from one vendor, you don't like the way their firmware starts to install, so you buy from a different vendor. The important part is you up-level the competition. You force us to do better. And quite frankly, we're ready for that conversation, and we're ready for that competition, which is why I'm comfortable standing on the stage and telling you, go ahead and replace me if you don't like it, because I know that you're going to keep us. So now let's touch lastly on the last little component, and that's System Center Orchestrator. 95% of what you're going to do is going to happen in band through those standards-based interfaces with SCVMM and Operations Manager. And if you're not looking for a private cloud, quite frankly, if you're just looking for simple virtualization, install Operations Manager and VMM and stop. You don't need the rest. However, if you are looking for cloud or for higher levels of orchestration and automation, Orchestrator is perhaps one of the most powerful products in the Microsoft portfolio. Now, long term, is it going to stay around? Who knows? Because right now it's getting kind of crowded, right? We've got Windows Workflow. We have the Workflow Foundation services inside .NET itself. Now there's Service Management Automation, SMA, inside the Windows Azure Pack, and a couple of other options that just slipped my mind. But Orchestrator is the old faithful. Orchestrator is able to communicate with just about any component inside the data center. And its real power is the fact that you can do standardized provisioning workflows, right, through a common automation engine that can be called externally by just about any service management application in the industry right now. So it's Microsoft's integration. There's other components, however, from a market share perspective, Orchestrator is the king. They were the market share leader when Microsoft made the acquisition a couple years back, and they continue to dominate in the space. We'll see where it goes moving forward, but for now it's there. The reason I bring it up is because you're going to run into scenarios where the standards-based management interfaces fail you because it's unique to your vendor. Right? There's stuff that we do that nobody else does, and there's stuff that our competitors do that we don't do. That's why there's multiple brands. That's why there's competition, right? And when you want to leverage those interfaces, the question is, do you want to have to send someone down to the data center every time you're going to do that? Well, how many people do you have, and how many hosts do you have? If you have 4 hosts, sure, go down there with the thumb drive and load them manually. If you have 50, that's not going to work. Right? So let's take a look at what's possible. Here we're going to do what I like to call bare metal rapid provisioning. So before we deployed a physical, we deployed a virtual machine in about 3 minutes, start to finish, leveraging the power of ODX. Here we're going to provision a Hyper-V host, doing almost the same thing. This is going to run really fast, so I'm going to walk you through how this works before we go ahead and hit play. So what we have here is our System Center Orchestrator runbook. The service request comes in through initialized data, and then we're going to reach out through our UCS manager. This is going to leverage FlexPod, so this is going to use Cisco's UCS platform. We're going to clone our service profile. Once the service profile has been cloned, then we're going to go into a parallel execution step where we start associating the service profile, zone the fiber channel fabric, because this is FCOE boot, and then while those two actions are running, we're also going to kick up here and reach out to the NetApp. We're going to clone our LUN using LUN-based array cloning. Then we're going to mount the disk on a midwife host, where we're then going to inject sysprep into that block-based LUN. This is the same exact workflow that VMM uses to deploy a VM. It attaches a floppy drive that has the unattend on the floppy. That's not practical on bare metal. So we're mounting the LUN, shoving a custom sysprep into the Panther directory, and then we're going to dismount it and mount the LUN back up to the service profile. Here's the interesting part. You're going to see in the demo that we get to this junction here in about 15 seconds. And at that point, Windows has been fully provisioned. It just doesn't know it yet. The rest of the time is waiting on the actual hardware to boot. Once we fully boot and run through sysprep, we're then going to kick it out to VMM, where we're then going to add it into Virtual Machine Manager. So let's take a look at what this looks like. Excuse me. Here we have our Service Manager portal. I have exposed a service offering. I'm going to go into the FlexPod Infrastructure Management service offering. In there, I have add Hyper-V host service request. I'm going to go to my simple request form where I have a single mandatory parameter of a host name. I'm going to deploy a ZAC host. Go through, hit submit. And our service manager request is submitted. So now we're going to go into the request so we can monitor its status. We can see it's pending. We'll refresh the page. It's been approved. We'll hit refresh again. It's running. So over in Orchestrator, We're going to hit refresh. We see that our runbook is running. We can see that it's cloning the service profile. Let's go to UCS Manager. Inside UCS Manager, we can see that it just popped in. There's our ZAC physical host, and we can see it provisioning. I told you this thing ran fast. Now it's fully provisioned. If we go back in and hit refresh, look, we're done. It's all been finished. We're just down here waiting on sysprep, or waiting on sysprep to run. So now we'll connect into the KVM console, and we'll watch a little bit of this. In real life, this step takes about 5 minutes because we're dealing with physical hardware and massive amounts of memory, so it just takes time. But here we're going to connect in. You can see it comes in. I fast forward about 3.5 minutes so we don't have to watch it. See it finalize the settings. Log in. Run a series of post-configuration scripts that finish it, basically setting up remote administration, connecting in and configuring the Hyper-V standard switches, and a couple other custom settings. And there we go. We go into the local server. We can see the name that we set inside the service request has been configured. We go back to our runbook. We're running in VMM. So let's go back to VMM, where we're now adding the host into the virtual machine manager. Absolutely zero administration overhead. I go to a web page, I type in a name, I click next. 10 minutes later, I have a host ready to take virtual machines inside virtual machine manager. That, my friends, is bare metal rapid provisioning. That is only possible utilizing workflow. And Orchestrator, quite frankly, is one of the most powerful tools in the industry today for doing such. Honestly, next year I bet we're doing this in Service Manager Automation, SMA. Because it's in some ways it's a little bit better of a tool. The real advantage of Orchestrator is we have native interfaces into stuff like SSH and SOAP and REST and the ability to just execute C# code if we choose to. And the fact that it has such a rich vendor integration through Orchestrator integration packs. But the real takeaway here is the native tools are going to give you 90% of what you need. And the other 10%, if you're of sufficient skill, again, more than 10 of any task needs to be automated, then runbooks and workflow is the best way to do that. And doing that is, again, going to maximize your throughput, right? FlexPod deployment is something I don't think about anymore because I've had this runbook for 3 years. I stand up System Center, I configure my runbook, I import it, I change a couple passwords, and that's how I deploy Hyper-V because it's faster and it's easier. Right, so this is a problem I don't have to solve ever again. And that's really the beauty of how this works. You solve it once, it goes into your catalog, and then you move on to the next one. And you just keep chewing your way through that list of backlog. And slowly but steadily, you move from putting out fires and fighting uphill to sitting back and just playing zone defense and making sure everything runs smoothly. That's the promise of IT as a service. That's the promise of private cloud infrastructure. And if you follow through on the vision, it's possible. It's just hard to kind of take that initial investment, the first step, put out the first fire, or let the first house burn down while you build the platform so that you can actually start to fight them efficiently. So now let's put this all together. I told you before, Virtual Machine Manager was the heart of the cloud. Virtual Machine Manager, of course, has a couple of abstraction layers built into it. We have, of course, our host cluster abstract, which abstracts away Hyper-V, Zen Server, vSphere, away from the physical infrastructure. So we logically provision against various hypervisors, regardless of their actual physical capabilities. We also have a library server, which is anything that's not stored on the Hyper-V host. All right, simple way to think about it. Anything that you want to take off of the hosting infrastructure goes in the library. And then we've got storage pools, which is that neat little abstract, which I told you before is standards-based management. So that's how we connect data on tap into storage pools. That's what connects that industry standard number one storage management operating system into Virtual Machine Manager. All of this is then exposed through a private cloud abstract, right? So the administration fabric management team, they look here and back. Everyone else is right here. So it's a single point of management, a single point of delegation. If you want to make a change inside your entire organization, you go to the private cloud construct, you make the change there, it's instantly propagated out. And the best part about this is the way that Microsoft has built this solution stack, all of the other integration components talk through it. Right? So it doesn't matter if you want to use App Controller or Service Manager Self-Service Portal in the Cloud Service Process Pack, or the Windows Azure Pack, perhaps the tenant portal. All of them go through the same common cloud construct. Another way to put this is by building this solution this way, you're actually connecting VMM, in our case, the data on tap 8, again, the industry storage number one storage management OS, which means you're really connecting it to everything that that platform can do. In our case, we're dealing with a non-disruptive platform with native secure multi-tenancy, seamless scale, intelligent caching, built on a unified architecture with native storage efficiency where we can deduplicate and flash accelerate the entire storage workload. Say that 10 times fast. Can you tell I've been doing this a couple years? This is the beauty of it. I don't have to write a custom workflow. I don't need to go to a third-party portal. I don't need to go in and tear out your existing management product for you to be able to get access to everything my products can do natively, because I've got this standard interface that does the translation for me. Now, can I configure, for instance, deduplication using SMIS? No, I can't. But I don't need to, right? I set that once on the storage controller. It's set for life. I don't ever need to touch it again. What I do need it to do is the stuff you do a lot. Provision storage, create VMs, and it does that. And in our case, it's going to do that leveraging that deduplication engine, the virtual storage tiering technology, the storage efficiencies to natively accelerate all of these deployments. Let's take a real quick look at what this looks like. So here we have a private cloud environment that has got a little crazy with their POC, and they've decided to deploy all of the above. So up here in the top right, we've got our traditional service manager in that same FlexPod service offering we were looking at earlier. In the top left, we've got App Controller, our good old friend. I absolutely love App Controller, by the way. That's a fabulous product. Bottom right, we've got the Windows Azure Pack. If you guys haven't seen it before, there you go. It looks just like Azure. That's the whole point. And then in the bottom right, we've got System Center Virtual Machine Manager. Now, at first, this can start to look like kind of a mess. It looks a little chaotic, right? You've got different users going through different portals. The help desk is trying to help the user understand where they're at. Are you in the Windows Azure Pack or the App Controller Pack? Are you going through Service Manager? No, I don't know why you can't see that VLAN. What's going on over there? I don't know. It's not working. Maybe it's working. I can't tell. It seems like a mess, but it's really not. Because regardless of which portal they go through, and regardless of how they actually handle the provisioning task, there's a common element here. And that common element is Virtual Machine Manager. VMM is how all of these tasks are eventually going to be completed. Which means as the application administrative team, as the fabric management team, that's where you watch. And regardless of which portal you come from, you're going to get the same ODX acceleration, the same storage efficiency, the same consistent deployment experience. That's the beauty of this solution stack. If you like the way Azure looks, if you're looking at using Azure for actual public cloud bursting, then the Windows Azure Pack is a home run because it's a common experience for your users. Regardless of if they're using the public cloud infrastructure or the private cloud infrastructure, their experience remains the same, right? If you're not using that, App Controller is great. If you want to use enterprise class service ticket management, you can use Service Manager. But regardless, you get the same integration, the same level of experience. So it's not either or, it's and, right? Perhaps you need to use a little bit of all of the above. And then, of course, when we zoom back out, we can see the provisioning tasks have completed in our various portals, and our virtual machines are up and running. So that's really the power of the Microsoft Cloud. And the key takeaways, again, there are simplify your architecture with SMB 3.0. Just step one, make your lives easier. There's no reason not to. The protocol is ready for prime time. And then make sure that you're leveraging the ODX acceleration. In our case, these copy offload transfers are actually storage efficient. So I just deployed 3 virtual machines. It cost me maybe a meg of actual storage because we're utilizing our FlexClone technology to pre-deduplicate these virtual machines at provisioning time. That's why it's so fast, quite frankly. That wasn't some massive storage array with a ton of SSD spindles. You know, that was just regular 10K SAS and not that many of them to begin with. It's just doing a more intelligent copy. Okay. Home stretch. Let's talk about public cloud. Let's talk about extending your private enterprise up into the public cloud. If we look forward to private to hybrid and then hybrid to pure public, which is where certain vendors would love you to go. We're really good at this right now. As an industry, we know how to do this, which is kind of funny because 4 years ago, private cloud was this mythological thing that we were up here telling you guys about, and everybody's like, IT is a service, whatever. You know, today, it's a reality. We know how to do it. The whole concept of a service catalog and working with the business to let the business pay for the resources that they want and do on-demand self-service through common portals and chargeback. These are concepts that have been implemented and successfully across the board. So now we're moving on to this commoditization of the actual infrastructure itself and saying, okay, we've simplified the IT service management lifecycle. So now let's see if we can just remove the physical infrastructure completely from this and translate all of this CapEx into OpEx. When we talk to top enterprise customers about why they're looking at public cloud, today there's four primary use cases. The first of which, of course, is peak workload. That's your cloud burst. Then we have dev test, which is moving dev test up into the cloud, keeping your production resources on private on-prem. Particularly for like banks and financial, this is a big use case. Because they don't want to pay for the compute resources to do development or QA, but they also don't want to put customer financial data in the public cloud for pretty obvious reasons. So for them, it's kind of a home run. Migration upgrade, this is kind of a niche one, but kind of interesting, where you would migrate a service to public cloud so that you can upgrade your on-prem resources and then bring it back on-prem when you're done. And then finally, we've got the disaster recovery use case, which I think is actually going to be the most predominant, at least initially within the industry, because it kind of makes the most amount of sense. It costs you nothing when the VMs are off. They're there, they're waiting, and then when the disaster happens, you only start to pay for your DR site when the disaster actually occurs, which kind of makes a lot of sense. So, how can we actually maximize this? Well, at NetApp we have a solution we call NetApp Private Storage for public clouds. Basically what we've done is we've worked with just about every hyperscaler and service provider in the industry to build a standards-based architecture whereby you can connect enterprise-class storage directly to a public cloud resource, meaning you still get to leverage the compute services of the public cloud provider. You still get to leverage the storage services of the public cloud provider where it makes sense. Go ahead and leverage S3 or REST or Azure EBS. Whatever you want to utilize, that's fine. But there's certain data that isn't really fit for the cloud today, right? There's security concerns. There's constructs. There's performance problems. You know, the erasure coding that Azure's done in particular is actually really impressive, but it's not perfect yet. And these are becoming inhibitors to actually making this a reality today. So NPS or NetApp Private Storage is an architecture where we can help bridge that gap while the cloud providers finish building their infrastructure and learning the lessons the hard way, running these real-world applications. How can we seamlessly connect to those cost-effective, high-compute, high-network clouds and still maintain control of our actual data, the IP, you know, the whole thing you're here to do in the first place, the business? From a connectivity perspective, up until yesterday, the way that you would do this with Azure is through a VPN. So you could take your on-premises NetApp FAS or FlexArray controller and through a high-speed VPN connect to the Windows Azure Cloud. This is well-suited for asynchronous operations, mainly because of latency. Right? Going through the internet with a VPN for a storage-based connection. For files, when you're just reading it, it's okay, but like iSCSI over 25 milliseconds is almost unusable. So it had kind of an edge use case. But it's still something potentially to consider because it costs you nothing. You can utilize your existing storage controller. You can utilize your existing footprint to extend natively into the public cloud. As of yesterday, we got ExpressRoute, which means that we can now do anything in the cloud. We can take that same controller, put it in a certified colo, connect it through ExpressRoute, and now we have a low latency, high bandwidth connection directly into the compute cloud, right? In other words, you have direct access to, I don't know, about 1 million virtual machines if you choose to spin them up. And you have the network pipe to handle that kind of I/O. So it's a very, very compelling scenario. From an architecture perspective, we're done. There you go. We can build anything you want to build today. We now have the building blocks to make it real. Now, there are other considerations. There's cost, complex. You know, which colo are you going to utilize? Which data centers are you in? You know, when is it fully in production? But for us, the architecture's finished. Now it's a problem. Now it's a business problem. Now it's sitting down with customers, talking about their actual use cases and helping them workflow how to make that real today. But you know, from our actual real world deployments, it's proven extremely successful. For instance, we have a mid-sized manufacturing company. This one's not using Azure, go figure. That is doing disaster recovery for SAP, in this case with Amazon. But they are looking at Azure. FlexPod on-prem, using NetApp SnapMirror to replicate their actual data up into the public cloud, where then they have a hot standby DR resource for their SAP infrastructure. So this is that disaster recovery instance, but it's not DR with one or two VMs. It's DR with their core SAP infrastructure that the entire business runs on, and there is zero delta between their on-prem and their public cloud architecture, because they have the same guaranteed high performance, and network is network and compute is compute, right? So this isn't surprising. If you have 24 spindles on-prem and 24 dedicated spindles in the public cloud, you're going to have the same performance because the VMs are the same. Another potential use case is the cloud burst for peak workloads. Here we have our on-prem copy, which is used mainly for dev test and proof of concept. We then replicate it up into the cloud, again, to the certified colo, or we could connect it in through the VPN. And then in the event of a hammering workload, we just simply flex clone the baseline, spin up those virtual machines for the extent of the actual burst workload. And then once the workload ends, we seamlessly remove those virtual machines, and we stop incurring charges the second we hit stop, right? Cloud burst is what led to us building public clouds in the first place, right? That was the use case that has brought us to where we are today. It's not the only use case. Again, I happen to be of the opinion that DR is going to be the primary use case going forward. But cloud burst is obviously the one that led to the architecture in the first place. Then we've got dev test production. This is a pure cloud architecture, right? So this is a business that said, we are out of the data center space. We don't own data centers. They probably don't own computers either. They probably lease them. They've completely gotten out of the hardware game. They got a couple wireless access points. That's it. Doesn't mean they don't have IT, though. And it also doesn't mean that they don't still need enterprise-class storage. In this case, we can leverage the high-speed compute infrastructure and do geolocation failover between the two clouds using array-based replication to synchronize the data. Now, some of the reasons that you're still going to want to utilize enterprise-class storage, even in a pure cloud environment, is, quite frankly, you could turn on a VM today, and it'll be amazing. And then tomorrow you turn it on, and it's slow. And the day after that, it's okay. And the day after that, it's really amazing again. And the day after that, it's unpredictable, unless you want to pay for expense. You can come out pocket and guarantee IOPS, and then you'll have performance. But the second you start guaranteeing IOPS, it's no longer cheap. Right? And you start to get in this scenario where over a five-year cycle, it's actually more expensive to leverage public cloud REST storage than it is to just buy your own. And if you buy your own, you get a couple of native benefits, the first of which is predictable performance. You tune the performance. You own the storage. The second is data integrity. You don't have to worry about the replication and erasure coding and various replications of what happens if this data center goes down and that data center goes down and I lose my WAN link and nah. None of that's there. Enterprise storage has been around since the beginning. It's a known quantity. The cloud compute concept and the cloud burst network concepts and the network virtualization layers, those are also known quantities. This is a zero risk proposition. It's a safe way to move to a pure cloud architecture. Listen, eventually you're probably going to get rid of this, if I'm honest. Because eventually they're going to figure it out. They're going to get it right. And then we're going to have to move to something else. But we're not there yet. So there's still some benefit. And then there's the big one for me, which is security. You know, especially in the United States these days. I don't know that I would necessarily be too comfortable putting my core IP in an environment that is subject to U.S. subpoenas. So, you know, if it's on your own storage, inside your own data center cage, inside a colo, behind a lock that you own and no one else has, encrypted with a key that you have and no one else has, there is no risk of anyone getting your data, period. If it's sitting in someone else's Cloud Elastic container, they're brilliant and they really know what they're doing, but something's going to happen eventually. And this isn't FUD. This is just facts, right? It's going to happen. It already happened with Amazon a couple times. So that's a pure cloud architecture. And of course, doing so gives you the benefit of pay-as-you-go compute and enables multi-cloud architectures. And that's where it starts to get fun. Because let's say, U.S. West was Amazon, and U.S. East happened to be Azure. And maybe we wanted to stand it up a U.S. Central that is VMware Hybrid Cloud Services. Leveraging a common compute workload, you could set up a standard services delivery using that single storage platform to utilize compute services in all those cloud service providers. Meaning you as a customer can now start sharpshooting the market and saying, okay, well, Azure lowered their rates this month, shut down Amazon, bring up Azure. Oh, VCHS has got a discount. All right, we'll shut down Azure, bring up VCHS. And really just start commoditizing the market and making them get price competitive. Because the problem with these cloud environments is this concept of data having gravity. Large amounts of data become orbital bodies in and of themselves. They're hard to move. So you end up building architectures around your data. And the services that run inside your ecosystem, they orbit the actual data itself because the data is hard to move. By co-locating the data external to the cloud provider, you're able to seamlessly move your services from one cloud to another, back on-prem, back to the cloud, back to this cloud, back to this cloud, without any penalty. So it really frees it up. I'm not saying everybody should do that, but we like to believe in options, and we like to help our customers build them. All right, here we go. Summary. So Windows Server 2012 R2, new protocols, SMB 3.0 and ODX, critical. Demand it from your vendors. Manageability, you need to have PowerShell. There's no excuse these days. SMIS is going to be important. Those vendor-based GUIs can be helpful, but they're not mandatory. Looking at System Center Operations Manager, or System Center 2012 R2, Operations Manager, mandatory. Virtual Machine Manager, mandatory. Demand it from your vendors. It's not acceptable. Orchestrator, maybe you need it, maybe you don't. But if you do, it's a pretty cool tool. And then again, by next year, I fully expect we're going to be talking about the Windows Azure Pack. And then finally, Microsoft's public cloud architecture with NetApp MPS. What if you could? Well, you can. If you're looking for a turnkey solution that happens to integrate all of what we've talked about for the past hour, please take a look at our FlexPod data center with Microsoft Private Cloud reference architectures that we do with Cisco. Last year, we were winner of Best of Tech Ed in the service management category, which I find kind of amusing. A rack won Best Management, which is, normally that's a software component. If you're interested, we have released our Fast Track 4.0 validated design. So if you're looking for a turnkey, safe, known good option for Windows Server 2012 and System Center 2012 R2 private cloud deployments that fully integrates with ODX, the Windows Azure Pack, using a service provider level, single, highly available hardware platform, please take a look at FlexPod Data Center and Microsoft Private Cloud. For more information, of course, you know where to go. Resources, Channel 9. Okay, please complete your evaluation.